Hello, everyone. I'm Stephen Reisner, and this is Madness, where psychology and capitalism collide.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
Last month, three Jews were murdered at a deli in New Jersey because they were Jews. The perpetrator left a note that read, "I do this because my creator makes me do this, and I hate who he hates." 2 weeks later, three Hasidic Jews in Crown Heights were punched by a homeless woman shouting, "Fuck you, Jews." And the next day, five Jews were stabbed by a schizophrenic black man with a machete in Muncie. I am coming to you today from New York City, where my fellow Jews are suddenly expressing fear of walking in the streets looking, well, like Jews. This is a shock because until recently, by which I mean until Trump, anti-Semitic incidents in this country and in New York City had become rare, and violent attacks against Jews were almost non-existent. In the 3 years since Trump became president, there have been more fatal anti-Semitic attacks in America than there were in the entire 20th century. In New York City, the number of hate crimes against Jews has increased 100%, and they are becoming increasingly violent. And that's what I will be focusing on today. I do this for two reasons. First, because I am a Jew. And as Hannah Arendt put it, if you are attacked as a Jew, you have to fight back as a Jew. You cannot say, "Excuse me, I am not a Jew, I am a human being." And second, because attacking Jews in New York City just seems weird to me. Aside from the fact that New York is a city with more diversity than any other city in the world, there are more than 800 languages spoken here. This is also the city that has more Jews than any city in the world, more than Tel Aviv, more than Jerusalem. I always thought of New York as a place where alienated people came to be around other alienated people. Irish, Italians, Jews, the Great Migration, queer people. Marginalized people have poured into this city for centuries. So it was even more confusing to discover that the perpetrators of these recent anti-Semitic hate crimes were not Trump-supporting white nationalists, but black people with apparently serious mental illness. Sufferers causing suffering to other sufferers sounds like madness.
So it has to be very austere. I have a whole thing about it. Let me explain Jewish and Goyish to you. Okay, first the literate. Goy.
In the late 50s and early 60s, Lenny Bruce did a routine where he divided the world into Jewish and Goyish. He said, if you live in New York or any other big city, you are Jewish. It doesn't matter if you're Catholic. If you live in New York, you're Jewish. If you live in Butte, Montana, you're going to be Goyish even if you're Jewish. It's hard for people today to understand what he was talking about. So let me explain. When Lenny Bruce did that routine, Jews did not consider themselves white. Jews believed, myself included, that only white Anglo-Saxon Protestants were really white. We believed that in America there were white people, WASPs, and there was everyone else. So when Bruce said goyish, he really meant waspish, white people in power-ish. And when he referred to Jews, he really meant everybody else. Lenny Bruce was an idealist who thought those who didn't have power had something else, culture, character, sexuality. And this gave the rest of us something in common. He went on, Kool-Aid is goyish. Evaporated milk is goyish, even if the Jews invented it. Chocolate is Jewish. Fudge is goyish. Blacks are all Jews. Italians are all Jews. Irishmen who have rejected their religion are Jews. Mouths are very Jewish. And bosoms, baton twirling, goyish. I had a close friend in high school, Carl. He was the first one to teach me about race relations. It was 1970. I remember one night he was sleeping over and he said to me, "You owe me for 400 years. I said, "My parents only came to America in 1950. At most, I owe you for 20 years. James Baldwin, writing in the New York Times in 1967, explained that American blacks did not see marginalization the way Lenny Bruce saw it. In an article called "Blacks Are Anti-Semitic Because They Are Anti-White," Baldwin wrote, "The most ironical thing about black anti-Semitism is that the black is really condemning the Jew for having become an American white man, for having become, in effect, a Christian." Baldwin's point is essential, that Jews, including Lenny Bruce, including me, assume something about being marginalized that blacks don't have the privilege to assume. And that is the idea that suffering confers a kind of universal moral authority. Baldwin said, "The Jews' suffering is recognized as part of the moral history of the world in a way that black suffering is not. The uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto was not described as a riot." Speaking as a Jew whose grandparents were murdered in the Warsaw Ghetto, I read Baldwin's words and I understand that the antagonism of blacks and Jews is deeper and more complex than I had imagined. And I will return to this, but for the moment, I want to focus not on the fact that the offenders in these cases were black, but on the fact that they were psychotic. Because I think it is essential today to highlight a psychotic process being mobilized by Trump and the Republicans, by the people who in my day were referred to as WASPs and who Baldwin was referring to when he spoke of Christians, white men in power, looking to stay in power. But to get there, I have to talk about psychosis and about paranoia and the distinction between them, even though the two can and do overlap. I am going to be arguing that psychosis is a psychological problem, but paranoia is in very large part a political problem. A political problem to which psychotic people are extremely susceptible. It could be said that psychotic people are the canaries in our national coal mine, breathing the vapors of paranoia emanating from the cracks in our democracy. For the most part, people don't understand psychosis. So I want to take a moment to help those of you who are not psychotic to understand what it's like to be psychotic. Simply put, psychotic people have a problem holding on to the structure of things. They don't easily grasp how things are organized and how other people understand the organization of things. Because of this, they have a hard time making sense of their own experiences, sometimes even their own perception. As a result, psychotic people tend to be extremely sensitive to stimulation. The voices in their heads, the physical sensations in their bodies, the sounds and smells around them. When they are stressed, this gets worse. When they are afraid, it gets much worse. Some psychotic people simply get disorganized and require a lot of support and structure from people around them, from their families and their friends. But others experience this overstimulation as a kind of persecution. They desperately try to figure out who is persecuting them and why, especially when their perceptions and sensations feel like overload. So, in order not to lose their hold on what's real, some psychotics organize rigid belief systems that explain their persecution. Now, these belief systems don't arise in a vacuum. They are always connected to the culture that they live in. So, psychotic delusions can become organized around everything from religious doctrine to pseudoscience. There was a time when people blamed their psychotic experiences on the devil. You can hear that I'm in New York City. So, okay, I can continue. As I was saying, the psychotic uses the cultural information to organize these rigid explanatory systems. Sometimes they blame these experiences, the voices in their head, on the devil or transmitters in the fillings of their teeth. Nowadays, it is more frequent that people believe these sensations are caused by microwaves coming from cell phone stations or from satellites. Or they may blame the CIA, or the government, or the Jews. And more often, they are finding their conspiracy theories on Twitter from the president. Which brings us to paranoia. There is psychotic paranoia. That's what I was just describing. But there is also political paranoia. Paranoia used as a political strategy. We have been seeing rapid and radical change taking place in democracies around the world. The change, of course, is the election of authoritarian leaders who promote divisiveness and fear, who assert nationalism over democracy, and who brazenly promote a kind of purity of race, religion, and class. The kind of leaders we haven't seen win democratic elections since the fascists took power in Europe in the 1930s. These changes are happening at breathtaking speed all over the world, in the United States, in Britain, Italy, Brazil, India, Turkey, Egypt, the list goes on and on. I am convinced that it is no coincidence that these changes are happening simultaneously with the two other extraordinary changes that have taken all of humanity by surprise. The rapid global deterioration associated with climate change, and the huge and increasingly globalized wealth and power disparity that is the result of runaway capitalism. In the face of these overwhelming changes, citizens in the democracies seem no longer to be voting based on their values. It seems they are voting based on their fears. And the leaders that are being elected are being elected because they know how to exploit and incite those fears. When Trump describes immigrants as rapists and criminals, and Muslims as murderers beheading Christians, he is inciting fear. And more than that, he is generating a culture of paranoia. It's no coincidence that since Trump was elected, hate crimes have risen all over America, but they have risen twice as fast in areas where Trump has held his rallies. Hannah Arendt, perhaps the clearest philosopher of paranoid culture in American history, studied the strategic power of authoritarian rhetoric. She wrote, "Before mass leaders seize the power to fit reality to their lies, their propaganda is marked by its extreme contempt for facts as such. For, in their opinion, fact depends entirely on the power of the man who can fabricate it. Paranoia is a process of fabricating facts. It always involves a rapid shift from suspicion to belief without taking the intermediate step of reviewing the evidence. In the political sphere, paranoid culture relies solely on the persuasiveness of the leader who replaces fact-based logic with emotion-based logic." Listen to how Trump justified the murder of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in an interview with Laura Ingraham on Fox News.
Do they have large-scale attacks planned for other embassies? And if those were planned, why can't we reveal that to the American people? Wouldn't that help your case?
I can reveal that I believe it would have been four embassies. And I think that probably Baghdad already started. They were really amazed that we came in with that kind of a force. We came in with very powerful force and drove them out. You know, that ended almost immediately. But Baghdad certainly would have been the lead. But I think it would have been four embassies, could have been military bases, could have been a lot of other things, too. But it was imminent. And then all of a sudden, he was gone.
There is no need in paranoid culture to support the emotional logic with facts, since the truth is based on Trump's beliefs and feelings alone. And what makes this situation reminiscent of the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century is that Trump's cabinet parrots Trump's emotional logic. This is Mark Esper, the Secretary of Defense, speaking after Trump's interview.
Can you clarify, though, was the specific threat that the president shared with Fox News about four U.S. embassies being under threat also shared with Congress? Why was there a difference?
What the president said was he believed that it probably and could have been attacks against additional embassies. I shared that view. I know other members of the national security team shared that view. That's why I deployed thousands of American paratroopers to the Middle East to reinforce our embassy in Baghdad and other sites throughout the region.
And it was on the basis of accepting the emotional logic of probably and possibly and Trump's belief that the military acted. Soleimani was killed. And we came very close to a war with Iran. And it's not only the national security team, but it is the Republican Party and Fox News who are all magnifying the leap from suspicion to absolute belief, and from absolute belief to violent action. No act of Congress, No intelligence that supported the choice, just the will of a leader who rules with grandiose infallibility. In the 20th century, when authoritarian regimes promoted paranoid culture, vicious anti-Semitism invariably followed. This is also happening in the 21st century. But today, there is a completely new form of anti-Semitism taking hold, alongside the time-honored anti-Semitism of white nationalists and neo-Nazis. There is an anti-Semitism that professes to be pro-Jewish. At the same time as nationalist authoritarians like Trump, Johnson, and Orban spread bigotry and anti-Semitism in their own countries, they claim to be fighting anti-Semitism. How? Because they have aligned with a brother right-wing authoritarian figure, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu and his political associates have redefined anti-Semitism in purely political terms. An anti-Semite, according to Netanyahu's party, is not someone who hates Jews because they are Jews, but someone who questions the policy of Netanyahu's government. Anyone who questions Likud policies is considered anti-Zionist and therefore is an anti-Semite. According to Netanyahu, the International Criminal Court is anti-Semitic for investigating war crimes in the occupied territories, even though they are investigating Israelis and Palestinians. He has also called for a boycott of an Israeli TV station, calling the station anti-Semitic because they ran a story based on documents leaked from Netanyahu's recent indictment on bribery and fraud charges. And members of his Likud party have gone further. They call the station's reporting a blood libel. In this bizarre world of ethical revisionism, Netanyahu is providing cover for anti-Semitic authoritarians like Trump, like Putin, like Johnson, Orban, even Mateusz Morawiecki of Poland, as those leaders whitewash their country's anti-Semitic histories and circulate the crudest anti-Semitic tropes, so long as the targets of their anti-Semitic tirades are left-leaning Jews who criticize Netanyahu's Greater Israel policies. Netanyahu's son, Yair, posted a viciously anti-Semitic cartoon of Jews as reptiles and global conspiracists, apparently taken from a racist Facebook page. He photoshopped the image, superimposing the faces of George Soros and Israelis who oppose the politics of his father. But what twists my head completely around, like something out of The Exorcist, is the right-wing alliance of Trump Republicans, Netanyahu and his party members, and American evangelical Christians. It turns out that in the United States, the largest group of American supporters of Israel are evangelical Christian Zionists, outnumbering even Jews. Their support is based on the idea that the return of Jews to Israel was a necessary step on the way to the second coming of Christ and the rapture. When Trump moved the American embassy to Jerusalem, the ceremony was opened and closed by Christian Zionists. It was opened by Pastor Robert Jeffress, who is known for saying that once Jesus returns, Jews must accept him or go to hell. Hell, he said, is going to be filled with good religious people who have rejected the truth of Christ. The ceremony was closed by Pastor John Hagee, the founder of the evangelical group Christians United for Israel, who has argued that Hitler was part of God's plan to return the Jews to Israel. At Trump's recent White House Hanukkah party, Hagee and Jeffress were guests of honor. And to fully round out this picture, we have to add the fact that Vice President Pence and Secretary of State Pompeo are among our nation's 8 million Christian Zionists. What we have in America today is a right-wing government stoking bigoted white nationalist violence against immigrants, blacks, Muslims, and certainly Jews. At the same time, that same government is aligning with the bigoted Jewish nationalism of Netanyahu's government. This makes it possible for groups of every political persuasion on the extreme right and on the extreme left to find in the Jews something to hate. White nationalists can chant, "Jews will not replace us," while members of ethnic minorities in America can see Jews as the oppressors of their Palestinian comrades. New York City and its surrounding areas are becoming ground zero in the interplay of paranoid politics and paranoid violence. In New York City, wealth disparity is the highest in the nation, with the average income of the city's 1% over 100 times the average income of the remaining 99%. Homelessness has reached levels not seen since the Great Depression, with over 100,000 homeless people on the streets and in the shelters of New York. 10% of public school children in New York City are homeless. Over two-thirds of the city's homeless population is black or Hispanic, and the vast majority of the homeless men and women who live on the streets of New York are mentally ill. I believe we need to see the current upsurge of anti-Semitism erupting among the mentally ill in New York as a political fire alarm, warning of the coming conflagrations that are the inevitable result of unchecked paranoid culture. I remember one of the first times I spoke to my mother of her experiences during the Holocaust. I was 16, and I finally got up the courage to see if I could get her to talk about those experiences. And I wanted to go in chronological order. So she told me about the first event when the Nazis came into her town, and they gathered up all the Jews of Pabianica into the town square. They pushed all the Jews in a big circle. And then what they did was they took clubs and they started beating the Jews on the outside of the circle. And those Jews started to rush into the center of the circle. And they continued to beat them and beat them, whoever was at the edge of the circle. And more Jews rushed to the center of the circle. And my mother said that what she noticed was that there were some people who were pushing others to the outside of the circle so they could push themselves deeper into the inside of the circle. They were pushing the old and the infirm and the ones who couldn't protect themselves, and they continued scrambling to the center. And my mother told me that at that moment she understood that something fundamental had changed. From then on, she said, she understood that being a human being would not come naturally. That under those circumstances, you had to make an effort to be a human being, to keep your humanity. In the current political climate in America, Jews are faced with a choice. We can be the Jews that Baldwin described, Jews who have become white and have aligned with the authoritarians and the Christian Zionists in the belief that what is most important is our own survival and our power. Or we can be the Jews of 2,000 years of ethics evolving out of the crucible of our experience of hatred and bigotry and genocide. Jews who hold Hannah Arendt's maxim, if I am attacked as a Jew, I will fight back as a Jew, alongside Hillel's maxim, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when?
Die langen die Grenzen der Reich, den erschaffen, war dem, was bereut, eier Breut. Die langen die Grenzen der Reich, den erschaffen, war dem, was bereut, eier Breut. Die langen hier stehen, eier roten Gebäuden, der niedrig, heimlos verschwacht. Es darf schon der Kreuz helfen, da.
This is Stephen Reisner. This has been Madness, Where Psychology and Capitalism Collide.